had weapons of mass destruction, had programs to have more, never lost the intention to have such weapons, and if they ever got out from under UN sanctions, there can be no doubt that they would have rebuilt those stocks and have used such weapons. I mean, people say, well, how bad were they? Well, they gassed 5,000 people on a March day in 1988. Now, if you want to leave that same person in charge and go along in the naive belief that he wouldn't do it again or create that capability again or try to maintain such a capability, you can do so. But we gave him a chance. The resolution that we fought for and got out of the United Nations in the fall of 2002 said, turn it all in, make a declaration of what you have, and then let us check it. And he did not give an honest declaration, and he signed his own warrant at that time.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have questions as to why Saddam Hussein acted the way he did if he did not have weapons of mass destruction. Of course, the search is still on for them. Has the intelligence so far, though, that some see as being faulty, has that hurt you as the nation's top diplomat, probably as the world's top diplomat, as you talk with other world leaders? I mean, China this week, I don't know if you saw the article in the Washington Post, was quoted as saying, basically, we're not even sure that the U.S. intelligence on what North Korea has in terms of enriching uranium is accurate. Do you feel as though U.S. intelligence now will be more rigorously scrutinized?
Well, we are always rigorously scrutinizing our intelligence. And the Chinese, what they said with respect to North Korea is that the United States believes, and we still believe correctly, that the North Koreans were pursuing highly enriched uranium programs. And they acknowledged it to us. Now, they've backed off since then, but who would you rather believe, the North Koreans or our intelligence? I suggest it.
Shut the hell up, Colin Powell. What is this nonsense about they gassed the people in 1998 talking about Saddam? Look, you buffoonish terrorist thug. Sam ran over to Saddam's side, sending Rumsfeld to basically shake his hand and tell him all's well in the client state, man. And then you babble out. He never lost his intention to build weapons of mass destruction. Whether he did or not, and we don't have any evidence, and you can't really read his mind, fool, that's not the point. And it doesn't give anyone, including a ruthless empire, the justifiable reason to go ahead and start occupying someone's land. Then you say, we want this war because he was the despotic regime that had weapons of mass destruction. Look, quit double speaking, you dog. Scott Ritter and everyone else knows and knew that he did not have weapons of mass destruction any longer. They were gone. Just like sooner or later, your master in your U.S. empire. Check this. You're listening to 104.1, 96.3, Santa Cruz, 106.7, Illinois, LUVER.com, The World Slave Revolt Radio. Tonight, we're going to go into what's going on with Negroes and black skin. How is it that so many of them keep going back and back and back to Master's cabin? You know what cabin is. It's called the Democratic cabin, as opposed to the one on the Republican plantation. You know where we're headed with that and news and a hell of a lot more. Slave Revolt. It's coming right at you.
Get 'em in, get 'em in. That sun is hot and plenty bright. Let's get on to business and get home tonight, beat 'em in. Auctioning slaves is a real high art. Bring that young gal, Roy, she's good for a start. Beat 'em in, get 'em in. Now, here's a real goodbye on about 15. Her great-grandmammy was a die-homie queen. Just look at her face. She sure ain't homely. Like Sheba in the Bible, she's black but comely. Bid 'em in. Gonna start at 3. Can I hear 3? Step up, gents. Take a good look-see. Because I know you'll want her once you see her. She's young and ripe. Make a darn good breeder. Bid 'em in. She's good in the field, she can sew and cook. Strip her down, Roy, let the gentleman look. She's full up front and ample behind. Examine her teeth if you got a mind. Bid 'em in, get 'em in. Here's a bid of 3 from a man who's thrifty. 325, can I hear 350? Your money ain't earning you much in the banks. Turn around, Roy, let 'em look at her flanks. Bid 'em in. 350's bidding, I'm looking for 4. At $400, she's a bargain, sure. 4 is the bid, 450. 5, $500, now look alive. Bid 'em in, get 'em in. Don't mind them tears, that's one of her tricks. 550's bidding, who'll say 6? She's healthy and strong and well-equipped. Make a fine lady's maid when she's properly whipped. Bid 'em in. 650, don't be slow. 7 is the bid, gonna let her go. At 7, she's going, going, gone. Pull her down, Roy, bring the next one on. Bid 'em in, get 'em in, bid 'em in.
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
Beyond the shadow. And tonight, you know, there's much madness going on in many ways in this world today. And in the corporate media world, and in much of the popular, progressive, mainstream, Americano-type minds, most would think that there's strong differences between certain people and black people in different ideological quote-unquote camps. But we're going to examine this a little bit more honestly tonight and deal with it beyond the shadow. You'll see what I mean as we progress. So first off, let's go into none other than Jesse Jackson. Jesse Jackson was on Amy Goodman's show, Democracy Now.
Mm-hmm.
And Jackson talks about the Democrats and the attacks that fellow Democrats are doing on Dean and how this may play out in a negative way and how and why he didn't attack his fellow Democrats when he was trying to, you know, be the main demo running for presidency in his campaign run in 1984 and 88. So let's hear what Jackson has to say, and then let's take it beyond the shadows. Check this out.
I was a tremor when I ran in 84 and 88 to put forth the idea of a new South Africa policy, Free Mandela. No matter what the question was, that was my answer. That was the point. The idea of a Middle East policy, a let's talk policy rather than a no talk policy, a two-state policy to end the present stalemate at that time. Now that is standard. It was a concern at that time for a drug policy given its impact upon the urban American youth. And so I chose not to attack Mondale and Hart over and over again because you must run under control with kind of one eye on competition to win and one eye on cooperation because the primaries is an intra-squad game. The big game is the interleague play after the convention. I think some of the Democrats have lost their way in this attack, and they unwittingly are doing commercials for Bush. They ought to be asserting their own plan to address 50 million Americans without health insurance. Their own plan to deal with how you stop the seepage, the hemorrhaging of jobs out of our economy. their own plan to educate our youth. And so I've been disappointed with some of the negativism in it. Having said that, Dean has weathered those storms, it seemed, at least so far. There's been a lot of bloodletting. I think in part because, remember last year, the largest demonstration in world history against unilateral invasion of Iraq. At that time, and many of the other competitors say we're kind of against the war, but we give Bush the right to do it. While they were hedging their bets, he went headlong against the war, and that gave him an edge among literally tens of thousands of activists. That became a point. He challenged Bush's tax policy, which many of them voted for, which enabled the top 1% to get a huge tax year, then go offshore and not pay taxes, and then get no bid contracts. And he took that kind of stuff head on. I think that's what gave him that traction among the voters.
All right. It's interesting hearing Jackson talk about how one must keep one eye on the competition and one eye on cooperation, and how you must run under control, and then the big game is interleague play. In a sense, he's right about the interleague play, because basically these guys are playing under rules that they agree upon, within a system that they agree upon.
Right.
So basically, it's not that much different than if you're a Raiders versus, you know, the Colts. You know, it's in two different leagues. But if you guys get together in the Super Bowl, it's not like the Raiders are going to have one set of rules that are outside the boundaries of football as opposed to the Colts. They're both playing a particular game within the confine. And with that in mind, so are the Democrats and Republicans. They're playing the game of market system capitalism. And that's something that they agree upon, that's set in stone. And those who venture out of that spectrum will find themselves under attack by both parties. Now, he won't say this, but this is how it basically works. So when you hear him mention about, you know, schools and the Democrats need to get a program together to, you know, how they're going to better educate youth and this and that. Well, when youth were being better educated in the 50s and 60s than they are today, it was both the Democrats and the Republicans, along with corporate America, that said we have to dismantle this public school system because we're not going to educate a bunch of knuckleheads that are going to prophesize overthrowing us.
Mm.
We're going to gumpify down as much as possible any kinds of institutions that allows this much flexibility within the working class. Now, this went across the spectrum. We've seen attacks on and a dismantlement of many urban cities. In New York and elsewhere, these have been part of a plan to basically disperse out large segments of the black community from having that integral net and unifying power that it once had. And actually, there was actually programs and outlines by the capitalists and acted out by various Democratic legislators and governors and mayors and Republican governors and mayors all down the line. My whole point is that after the working class has had major setbacks since the 60s at the hands of the Democrats and Republicans, and is in a very vulnerable situation, especially certain minority groups, the Democrats then try to come in and pretend as if they're on our side.
Yeah.
When they did everything they could to slow down and set off course and derail the political, social movements and the development of the urban black masses and the working class that was developing during the 60s. So when he talks all of this yip-yap stuff about, you know, how the Democrats are giving Bush commercials and all of that type of stuff, this is sidebar stuff, because the greatest commercial that could ever be used against the Democrats is if someone used the commercial of how they capitulated against the Republicans in the face of the Republicans intentionally scrubbing off 90,000 voters from the voting roll during the 2000 election. and how the Democrats made a block with the Republicans not to take that angle any further, even though it would have thoroughly discredited the Republicans, but it would also have damaged the system. And they were more concerned, the Democrats, about the false integrity of the system than they were for human rights and justice and civil rights for black people.
I think Tracy's absolutely right. Most of the most serious assaults on the rights, civil liberties, the rights of blacks and labor have been bipartisan. The Effective Death Penalty Act. This was not just Republicans voting on it. It was a Democratic president, Democratic Congress. And that haunts us to this day. Innocent people will die because of that. The omnibus terrorism bill that he passed, old crime bill Clinton passed. That was crime bill Clinton. Welfare reform, crime bill Clinton. We can go up and down the line. Nevertheless, I don't think we should underestimate the buffoonery of these right-wing Democrats that are hating on Dean. I am not a Democrat. Never have voted for a Democrat in my life. But it is a bit, it's true. It's a sideshow. It's not fundamental. But it is embarrassing. I mean, if I were a Democrat, I'd probably give it up with this, because this Lieberman has been pulling some really nasty little stunts. So has Gephardt. You know, Tracy, they actually wrote in the newspaper, one of them, you know, used a little shill to put in the newspaper, that Dean is not really a Democrat because he's kicking their butt. And they're just straight up trying to discredit him. Now, that's going a little bit far for a political difference. Why don't you explain the difference in your politics? No, they're attacking Dean real hard.
They're also sending out a message to anyone who's perceived, because it's just a false perception, that someone is quote-unquote anti-war and, you know, so on and so forth. In other words, the Democratic Party has developed within its own institutions by itself its own fertile ground of disciplining those who stray, quote-unquote, too far.
Mm-hmm.
So if you notice, none of them came to the aid of Cynthia McKinney when, you know, she made certain statements about Bush and she, you know, held strong her beliefs about the rights of Palestinians. So even though she was being attacked by the Zionist lobby, by the Republicans, and by
some Democrats
there was a hands-off approach by many of the Democrats from coming to her aid and saying, no, this is not how Democrats act. No, that is how they act.
True that. True that.
Next, Juan Gonzalez, a co-host of Democracy Now!, asks if Democrats should write off the South and develop a Southwest strategy. Let's see what Jackson has to say. Check.
In terms of the presidential race, there's the Republicans for many years, ever since Nixon, have been using what some call the Southern strategy, basically winning over white voters, conservative Democratic voters in the South who have opposed civil rights for many years and been able to fashion this huge majority in Southern states now in presidential race after presidential race. Mm-hmm. There are some people that are saying that the Democratic Party should stop trying to win the South when it has no chance of winning the South, but develop a whole new strategy, a Southwest strategy, to attempt to win over the huge growing Latino vote in the Southwest to one that obviously President Bush is going to be seeking to contend with.
You can't write off the South. First of all, you look at the Southern vote. This kind of anti-Martin Luther King backlash is a new Southern race strategy. In some sense, led by people like Trent Lott, by President Reagan.
Gingrich.
The point was that Martin Luther King has changed the South, changed our way of life. And we got to sit with them and go to school with them. And that they even got the right to vote against these political positions. So the movement as a kind of anti-Martin Luther King civil rights struggle was to play into the fears of the whites. Reagan's speech in Philadelphia, Mississippi, 1980 was, we are back. What a signal, we are back. And in some sense, the kind of anti-civil rights
drove many whites into voting their racial fears and pain against their economic interests. I said to 8,000 pillow tax workers in Kannapolis, North Carolina, a few months ago, they were weeping because they went to work one day and the plant was closed. And when the plant closed, jobs gone, no benefits, movie houses closed, can't pay the house note, can't pay the car note. Help us. I said, I want to help you, but many of you voted for Bush. They said, yeah, but we want you to help us. I said, you really got what you voted. You voted for the right to not be at the table. You voted for right to work laws. You voted for the right of the company to determine your destiny, close the plant without notice. The point is, the big challenge of the South is to keep working on getting more and more whites to vote their economic dreams and not their racial fears. Put it this way. In South Carolina last year, the race, governor's race, 300,000 blacks didn't vote in round numbers. 260,000 did vote. So more didn't than did. Lost the race by 40,000 votes. The numbers are there. In Georgia, lost the Senate race, Max Cleveland, by 30,000 votes. 600,000 blacks unregistered. So the unregistered black vote, and the emerging southern black and brown vote, the unregistered vote, and the registered who have despaired, that combination can change the South precipitously.
Now once again, Jackson is doing two things. Once again, he's saying that voting is the way out of this misery and
yes,
stuff.
Yes, he is.
And he's talking about how, 300,000 black people didn't vote in this particular area and so on and so forth. But you notice, I'm going to keep bringing this up. The Democrats did not come to the defense to the black people who did vote in Florida.
That's right.
These are messages that you send out. Now, here, all these black people had organized in Florida because they had been insulted by Jeb Bush and some of his actions and some of the things he said specifically about black people in the past. So they say, okay, we're going to get your brother because we know he's down with the same Klan. So here they vote, and here Jeb Bush and Catherine Harrison Company have this strategy to knock off blacks from the voting roll using this fake felony act thing, where only 5% of those 90,000 plus people who were scrubbed off the voting roll, only 5% were actual felons. All the rest had a right to vote. The Democrats, Jackson, all of them dropped the ball. These have ramifications too. You can't just jump over these issues and depend that they don't have any kind of social consequences. When people see you not act out, they say, well, oh man, well, what's the point? What's the point of supporting these clowns?
Precisely.
So just by ignoring this does not mean that, these things do not resonate in people's minds. Now, he talks about how this is an anti-Martin Luther King backlash and stuff like that. Actually, there's always been attacks on black progressive movements, black social movements, black gains from every step of the way. Every step of the way, from Reconstruction, attack, attack, attack. Jim Crow, our whole thing has been a constant struggle against the privatizers of this country to control our basic rights and our labor and our minds for that much. So from the black churches being burnt up a few years back, on down the line of all of these little Mississippi jail lynchings that were happening and still are happening, to Tulia, Texas. This is a constant thread that is deeply embedded in the American way of life. Now, when Jackson also mentioned that he told these people who are all losing their job that they voted themselves this way into this position because they voted for Bush and, you basically got what you got and all of that type of thing, there's literally millions of people who have found themselves in deindustrialized zones of this country as a result of legislation that Crime Bill himself passed, NAFTA, WTO backings. These
Absolutely.
Have had devastating impact on not only segments of the population in here, but throughout the world. The Zapatistas didn't rise up, because they didn't get their Cheerios one day. So for Jackson to try to position the Democrats once again as the defenders is him hiding in the shadows and trying to spin it out that Your salvation is what you vote for.
And actually, as Tracy has made abundantly clear, the reverse is true. You see, the only type of economic program that is in the interest of the overwhelming majority of the working people in this country is an economic program that attacks capital. You have to fight back, you know? And the Democratic Party, besides, you know, a little rhetoric here and there, Jackson's included, notwithstanding, has been on the forefront of these attacks against the working class. This is ridiculous.
Now, next, the other day, same week, David Hilliard, former Black Panther Party member, he was on a show with Davey D. And Davey D asked Hilliard, who, about the reign of terror and the reign of power that once existed in Oakland. So let's see how they start phrasing this, and then we'll take it from there. Check this out.
Talking about the fact that you are teaching a class at Laney College, Politics of Protest, and let me make sure I'm correct. Is you and former mayor Elihu Harris?
That's right. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So talk about this, because there's a rich history there, you know. Explain what this is all about.
Well, it's as it should be. It's consistent. There was a 110-year reign of Republicans in this city prior to...
In Oakland. You know, people don't know that.
Prior to Bobby Seale running for mayor. We were the first blacks to oppose the Republican administration, first African-Americans in this city. So when Bobby Seale ran for mayor, we got over 40% of the vote. We took that momentous event and all of those votes and applied it to support for Lyon Wilson,
right,
who became then the first African-American, first Democrat.
Right.
And as a result, then you had, of course, Elihu and now the Independent and the likes of Jerry Brown, who burned us all.
Right.
But, you know, we'll talk a lot about that. So it only makes sense that Elihu, who was also, he and Huey were also frat members, because Huey's a Sigma.
I didn't know that.
And
that's
so
right, yeah.
So it's important, and it only makes sense that Elihu is here to talk about really the last power base of African Americans in this city, which was he, Lionel, and now Willie is gone. So really, realistically, you have nothing left in terms of the impact of black political power in Northern California, especially Oakland, California.
You know.
Permit me. Now look, in defense of the early Black Panthers, I must say that when Bobby Seale ran for mayor, you understand, the Black Panthers were already on a downward political trajectory, a spiral, actually. Because before that, so that was the first time the Panthers ran as a Democrat. Before that, Huey ran for public office. A number of Panthers, Elvis Cleaver ran for president on a Peace and Freedom ticket. Huey was on the Peace and Freedom ticket. You know, Cleaver's wife, Kathleen Cleaver, was on the Peace and Freedom ticket because they wanted to oppose both the twin parties of capital. As the Panthers began to politically degenerate and drift to the right, that's when Bobby Seale came out as a Democrat. They almost ceased to exist within years of that. That was the end for the Panthers as a radical force. Now, they remain a force in the city and in city politics and in getting grants, etc., etc., but they were finished as a revolutionary force. Actually, a little bit before that actually happened, to tell you the truth. They had split. In 1971, the Panthers had a split and went from 5,000 members to about 2,000 members in 1 month. This was followed by a decree by Huey Newton that the Panthers were no longer going to be a national formation, but that all of the loyal Panthers that were still loyal to him should move back to Oakland or come into Oakland. And they were going to, quote, take over the city of Oakland, which meant that there was no Panther presence in the other cities that they had formerly been in. You understand? So I'm afraid that our friend David Hilliard is not being totally forthright.
You know, what's also sad is that when he talks about the Republicans having a 100-plus-year reign in Oakland, as if it's just a Republican thing, there are many towns and cities and states where there have been Democrats who had had long reigns. And guess what? Black folks were getting the lynch.
That's right, catching hell.
Martin King was in many of these southern states where they were Democrats. That was, a stronghold for many right-wing bastions.
Like the Klan.
Yeah. So to get into this whole Democrat, it's just sad.
Sick.
And then talk about the power base and the black power base being fermented within Democratic mayors like Lionel Wilson or Elihu, and then once that went, and then Brown came in and burnt us all, then it was all gone. Basically, he's defeated. And under that type of ideology and program, black folks will never reinvigorate our struggle in this country or in Oakland or anywhere else in around the world, which is going to happen. But he's just not going to be a part of it because he's one who basically is thrown in the towel on the early legacy of what the Panthers represented, which was an anti-capitalist formation and organizing across racial boundaries, et cetera, on a powerful, a formidable, class-conscious basis. Now, this stuff about... he's leading you in the same way, but not in the, he's not saying it so much, at least right now, but he's leading you basically within the same grips and on the same plantation that you just heard Jesse Jackson lead you. If Lionel Wilson and Elihu were the last bastions of black empowerment, and they were both Democratic mayors, and then now they're gone, and then that means that black power, as he defines it, has evaporated in Oakland and Northern California, then what's really fundamentally the difference of what Jackson is saying about what black people need to do?
There is no qualitative difference. And permit me to say this, too. Many of you might recall that Brother Hilliard was supposed to run for city council back in 1999, he said he was going to run in the 2000 election against Nancy Nadell. Yours truly, along with Old Running Horse, approached both Mr. Hilliard and his campaign manager, who at that time was Bobby Steele, and said, listen, if you run on the original Panther program and publish that and proclaim that you are neither a Democrat nor a Republican, we will go to work on your campaign. To this day, he has not called me to implement that program. You understand? He postured like that, but then when it came down to it, he didn't even run a campaign. Now, another interesting fact. Jerry Brown had been away from Oakland for years. He had been trying to run for president as an independent and stuff like that. So, you know, he had his little program, I forget the name of it, on KPFA and, you know, and was looked upon as an outsider to a certain degree. Who was it that took Jerry Brown by the hand and walked him into West Oakland and reacquainted him with the community, took him to the bars and the various other social locations and hooked him up so that he could, in fact, run for mayor? Because you can't run for mayor in this town without some connections to the black community. That person, David Hilliard. Yes, indeed, he did get burned, but not all of us. Although I will say Jerry Brown did fool a lot of black folks, he did not fool all of us.
Next, Davey asked Hilliard about how was Oakland like under the Democratic reign. So check this out.
Going back into history, and I like always taking advantage, we was talking about this off air, when we have folks who have been around for a while to give some of that history, because it's not given to you freely. You know, you don't go into the schools and they give you the Panther perspective What we'll see is a picture with some guys in a beret and a gun, and somebody goes, they were violent and they hated white people, and let's move on to Martin Luther King, you know. So it's always good to get these perspectives. But just the fact that you said that a city like Oakland, which is considered a very liberal city by standard, today's standards, and when we think of, you know, progressive activities, you think San Francisco, Berkeley, Oakland, the fact that it was such a Republican town, I mean, what was that like then? And how? And I mean, obviously, what was it taking for you guys to really flip the script, so to speak?
Well, that's what you'll learn in this course. I mean, it's really literally from the.
So you're not going to give me the 10-minute, well, the 10-second answer?
I'm going to try to give it to you. I mean, it was this era of segregation. You know, with
segregation in Oakland?
Students sit in, of course. Oakland had about 2 black police officers when I came here into this city in the 50s.
Hmm.
And certainly in the 60s, that's what gave impetus to our movement.
Right.
The fact that it was a police department that was totally dominated by people who came outside the city, some from back south. Police officers.
Now, they used to ship people from the south.
Mm. So we're going to teach a lot about that. But this course will also... talk about our coalition politics, our coming together with the Browns, with Cesar Chavez, the Brown Berets, the Latino community and the gay community and the progressive whites. And in the final analysis, we're going to talk about the Panthers, from the Black Panther Party to hip hop, where we'll bring it all the way forward and deal with what is going on now in 2004.
Now, once again, you know, everyone who knows about the history of the Panthers knows that the Panthers came together. And yes, why they concentrated on the police. As Huey always said, this was the most visible force in black people's lives. So it was an important tool to deal with, especially since it was on the minds of black people so much because of the presence and stuff. Huey always saw the larger picture and how the police were just an apparatus, an iron fist of the capitalists, and that being the iron fist of the capitalists from a class perspective does not mean that if there were some Negro police that somehow would make it, you know, a little bit softer, that they put on a glove on the iron fist so they wouldn't leave a fingerprint when they smash you in the ground. I mean, this is this silliness. Look, the Panthers dealt with the Oakland Police Department because of its role as a component of the capitalists. And that was an important aspect of bringing to light to black people in Oakland that, yes, not only could we fight back, but it was absolutely essential that we start fighting back.
And winning. By the way, it does need to be said that when the Panthers were present, the incidence of raw police brutality actually went down considerably. So he's taking what is an honorable history and dragging it through a latrine. Elihu Harris, oh man.
More on that later. Now next, let's go back to Jesse Jackson. As Jackson gives his spill about the potential Democratic voting black power base. Check this out.
1,000 blacks unregistered. So the unregistered black vote, and the emerging southern black and brown vote, the unregistered vote, and the registered who have despaired, that combination can change the South precipitously. Now, in the 1984, Amy, we thought we couldn't gain the Senate back. Because Reagan was at the height of his popularity. Because of the 84 campaign, we put on 2 million new voters. We regained North Carolina, Florida, Louisiana, Arkansas. We took the Senate back in 1986 because of the Southern, the black vote and the remnant of the white vote. So we should not write the South off, but we should expand to the Southwest.
Reports of Cynthia McKinney now trying to regain seat, take it back in Georgia. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporting that this week.
Well, she was awfully young to lose that seat, so she still has the will to fight back. But a big challenge in the South now is to revive the spirit of the Southern voters to vote and to vote in their interest. A combination of people who can no longer vote because of jail time, and unregistered voters and uninspired voters. We're losing big races by that margin. That's why I'm spending a lot of my energy with the Rainbow Push Coalition on voter registration, voter education, and voter inspiration. We won in 2000. We really can win again. Matter of fact, we've got more with which to fight now. After all, the net loss of jobs in every state. Poverty has increased. Middle class has been sinking. A jobless recovery is a swimming pool without water. You can't dive in that.
Now, outside of all the little nice lingo and stuff, I think if you listen carefully, you get the real concern that Jackson has. And this is of his party and his ideology's own undoing. When he says we must revive the spirit of the people, talking about black people, to vote in their own interests, basically he said that, look, black people don't have any faith in us. They're losing faith in the Democratic Party. They're not being able to distinguish any artificial differences between the Democratic Party and not. Now, this is a similar trajectory that the NAACP has fallen under. You don't see the NAACP playing a large presence in a lot of these urban communities and stuff like that. But, the people are still, have their little NAACP image award shows and all of that. How are they getting paid? Corporations.
That's right.
That's how. In other words, they're a corporate institution now. Now, the NAACP can still exist, not as a viable organization in black people's lives, but they can still exist, image-wise, without black a large black role in participation that once was the bedrock of that institution. But the Democratic Party, they need the votes of, the nod of approval come election time. And more black people are just becoming more or less laissez-faire about the Democratic Party. And he's trying to rekindle them, but he's trying to do it with a wet match. In other words, the Democratic Party has nothing really fundamental to offer black people. And most black people have been feeling the brunt of unemployment long before Boy George hit the office. They felt it all the way through Crime Bill Clinton's office.
That's true.
They felt the attacks of the drug war. Crime Bill Clinton's office. All of these various incarceration rates that grew dramatically. A large portion of it was during Crime Bill Clinton's administration. Right. That's the real world. So for just the average brother and sister on the street, you can't just come to them and just talk this little smack about voting in your own interest when they see and feel these types of hits happening to them constantly, administration after administration.
I can only say ditto on that. This Jackson, what is our economic, objective economic needs? We need jobs. If the corporations are actually shipping out jobs, that is against our interest. What are the Democrats even saying they're going to do about the outflow of jobs? I'll tell you what they're saying. All told, nothing. They better shut the hell up because they're trying to compete for the same money that the Republicans get from the corporations. When the last time you gave the Democrats any money? So all this talk, see, understand, when it comes to our economic needs as workers, black or white, a Democrat is nothing but a knife without a blade.
Now, Amy asked Jesse Jackson about him pulling out of being a player in the 2000 election scam in Florida. Let's see how Jackson handles this.
Amy.
Upon reflection now, do you think Al Gore was wrong to pull you back from major protests in the streets in Florida when the voter rolls were scrubbed, were purged? Many of those taken off those voter rolls were legitimate African-American voters who lost
Democrats
their rights.
Democrats made a big mistake, A, by not using Florida-based lawyers like Willie Gary, who's indigenous, who relates to the judges in that system as opposed to bring in Washington, New York lawyers. They made a big mistake by not fighting with great fervor. Many Democratic Congress people, senators, laid back to watch the Republicans fight. Now, pulling back was, I did not pull back, refused to pull back because I sensed what the stakes were. Now, when it went to Washington, the senators, in either of them, whether it was Kerry, Liebman, any of them had the right on the floor to ask for a hearing. They got caught up in political correctness, and they did not fight back. Didn't fight back in Florida, and didn't fight back in Washington. And non-fighters get what non-fighters get, losses.
I beg to differ with the Honorable Reverend, because, and brothers and sisters, check this for yourself. At a certain point, the anger of the black masses was so hot, there were demonstrations as large as 50,000 people. All of a sudden, there's no doubt, Gore said, look, that's enough. In fact, if you recall, before the election was really over, Gore called Bush and conceded victory. Somebody must have hit him in the head and snatched the phone, because they kind of cut that short. But that just shows you where Gore was coming from. Now, I'm sorry. I don't like to call Jesse Jackson a liar. But check the facts yourself. Gore told him, that's it. Well, that meant that was it in terms of the money that the Democratic Party was going to provide to organize the opposition to this, you know, to this scrubbing of the rolls. And after Gore said that, whether the Reverend likes it or not, you know, the Reverend has some money himself through Bush and all that. He could have put his own money forward if he wanted to. But nothing occurred after that, which means maybe he might have went and laid out on the beach in Miami somewhere, but he certainly did not continue that fight because he's capable of it. There's a lot of people, you know, yours truly, I probably couldn't go down there and start hiring organizers and getting the stuff out because it does take some money, you know, as somebody can. But Jesse Jackson had the capacity to continue that if he wanted to. But he was a loyal Democrat. Master shouted, he obeyed. I'm sorry. That's what happened.
That's exactly what happened. This is just a rewriting of history. We just saw Hilliard do a lot of rewriting. Now Jackson's doing rewriting. And it's also sick because also this is also a result of being loyal to a Democratic Party system as opposed to being loyal
to the black masses.
To the core of your own people.
That's it.
So then all of a sudden someone else can pull your strings. As Gerald said, there was 50,000 plus people. There were young students who were upset, first time voters, you know, in college, so on and so forth, who were up in an outrage that their name was like James T. Smith. And a guy named James Ramar Smith, who's 25 years older and lives in New York, name somehow knocked them off. That's because Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush used a voting a software system that if your name was even close, you would get knocked off. It didn't even have to be in the same state. In some cases, they used a time machine and went up into the year 2007, saw that you committed a crime and knocked you off for the year 2000. This is how sick the whole process was. So people were ready to fight. Remember, during that time, many just Democratic voters were all upset and calling the whole thing a farce. So when Jackson talks about, you know, he did not pull out and all of this type of stuff, he's just rewriting history.
Hold, just Tracy, just one more thing. Not only is he rewriting history, you got to say, Jesse Jackson is not like some little Pentecostal preacher on the corner working out of a little, you know, slummy building they converted to a church. Homeboy is a national figure. He's got clout politically in that regard. And also, he does have money, as I said. Now, look. Let's just say...
Well, we mentioned the aspect about how if he really wanted to, he could have. But he's a Democrat first.
Right. But it went further than that.
He's loyal to the Democratic Party.
First.
And he's more interested in black people being under the reign of the Democrat and all the terror that comes from it, as opposed to basically the black masses sparking out of control and going their own way and doing whatever is necessary to free themselves.
Now, here's something everybody here can understand. All of our listeners, just stop and think about this. Let's say, even if he conceded and Boss Man told him, all right, Jazbo, lighten up, stop making all that noise, you're causing a problem. What would stop Jackson from working with local groups to alter or abolish the law on the books that says that felons can't vote? By the way, you should know this, that law is not on the books in every state. Therefore, if he was serious about, you know, creating an independent black movement that was in the interest of blacks, he could have said, all right, look, let's change that law now so this never happens again. Did he do it? I'm sorry, y'all. He failed again.
And those laws came from a legacy of disenfranchisement intentionally by the white racists who sought to marginalize black folks after the Civil War. Now, let's go back to Hilliard. David D. asked Hilliard about his version of did black electoral politics work for black people. Check it out.
You have mentioned the fact that there were only maybe two or three black police officers and that we didn't have a lot of, you know, a lot of black folks in various positions.
We had very little black as a matter of fact.
So nowadays, you're able to look at, you know, some sort of track record and say, okay, we've had black police chiefs. Have police brutality gone away, yay or nay? We've had black mayors. Have the cities and the conditions in those cities improve, yay or nay? And we go all the way down the line. If you were, you know, well, you're still here being a part of the movement, do you think the strategy is to fight to get black and brown representation? Or do we fight to get the right people in position? Because some of these conditions haven't changed, and we do have black faces in some of these keeping positions in some of these leadership positions.
Well, again, you know, that's so much about what this class is about. It's about that and how we use the politics of electoral politics as a means of inclusion and of gaining power. No doubt our position was that, the struggle is all internal. Actually, you don't make change from external causality. It's all internal. So in order to be effective, yes, people should run for city council positions, run for school board positions, and begin to try to take the seats of power, because that's where you can make an
impact. But how do we keep this line of accountability, you know, going? How do we make sure that folks who we get behind are going to do the right thing by us? You know, and I'll give you an example. You know, I remember I was doing a debate. You know, you might recall this when Jerry Brown was running. And I remember at that time you actually were supporting him. You
Absolutely.
Stood up, in fact,
right.
and chastised me and said, this is a friend of the community. And then he turned around and, you know, the rest is history.
Good example.
How do we make sure that if we get behind folks, and as you did, put your name behind somebody, that we're going to make sure that they do the right thing?
That's a good analogy. As a matter of fact, you won't if you don't have the kind of political infrastructure that the Black Panther Party represented.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's all this empty gesture. My support for Jerry was really an individual accounting.
Right.
And Jerry Brown himself used to say to us that I'm so glad that the Black Panther Party is no longer around.
He did that day.
He says because that wasn't a politician's worst nightmare.
Yeah.
So the lesson that your generation should learn from us is that you need to have the kind of infrastructure that the Black Panther Party had that could bring pressure to bear on these politicians when they don't deliver. I think even with this recall with Gray Davis, I think that's a good check and balance system. If we got the power when politicians are not carrying out their mandate to say, all right, you out of here. And if anybody else that don't carry out this mandate, this is what they got to look out for, the power of the people. That's exactly what the Black Panther Party was around to do.
All right, basically you see how far Hilliard is deteriorated, because he turns around and says that and he missed it. He chastised David D. basically probably for challenging Jerry Stonewall Jackson Brown on a couple of questions, and says that this person is a friend of the community. But he says that he supported Jerry Brown on an individual basis. But if you say he's a friend of the community, you're seeing more than an individual basis.
Exactly.
Then Jerry Brown had the nerve to tell all y'all knuckleheads that he's glad that the Panthers aren't around today. Well, if some raggedy politician is saying that, you know he's not a friend of the community, because black
That's
people
exactly
in Oakland
right.
know what the Panthers That's represented. Right. So how could you let this fool get up here and tell black people he's glad that one of the most powerful social movements in black American history and for black people in Oakland no longer exists. He's glad it no longer exists. How could that punk possibly be a friend to the community? This is a damn shame.
It's not possible. It's not possible. But more importantly, let's go back to history. What was the issue that brought the Panthers together? It was police brutality to a large extent. And what was the original name of the Panthers? David knows quite well. It wasn't the Black Panther Party to run for office and join the Democrats. It was the Black Panther Party for self-defense. That was the original name and mission of the Black Panther Party.
Now, also, you know, all of this whole black empowerment through mayors and this and that. Look, black, when you got black mayors or black governors, that's basically having a black person in charge of a certain portion of a master's plantation. So he puts a little foreman in charge, you know, like of a Bantustan plantation. It's still master's land. He can still run whatever freeways he wants through your community. He can still use eminent domain to oust you. He can still use development to usurp you. He can still redline you because it's his plantation. It's his system. He's still the landlord. So the fact that he puts a little top hat on you and calls you mayor, that's not a real form of black empowerment. That's a minstrel show. What the hell is going on here? Now, next, Davey asked Hilliard about the original Panther position on capitalism. So let's see how Hilliard answers this, Big.
One of the things that you guys had always stood up against was, you know, you were very clear about the role that capitalism plays and the role of class, you know, how that has an impact. Today, do you still believe in that principle of smashing the capitalist with a raised fist, as Paris said in the song?
No, we support. Huey did a piece called Black Capitalism Reanalyzed. We were always one to check ourselves. So we think that it's necessary for blacks to have businesses, to make money, to be in ownership, own radio stations, own newspapers. It's about empowerment. That's what we fought for. That's what we died for. That's what we went to prison for. So we want to have our share of this economic piece of pie. It's called economic democracy. No doubt we should be in the business of ownership.
And what about electoral politics?
We should definitely be there, because if we had the right representatives with the kind of infrastructure that we talked about, then we could make some changes.
So once again, he believes that some changes can come, real changes, through the electoral process. Now look, the most important advancement black people have made is the crushing of chattel slavery during the Civil War. Frederick Douglass was one of the preeminent figures in that, how that played out. 200,000 blacks, 200,000 strong blacks joined to crush the South. That was a more important advancement towards freedom than the Civil Rights Movement. The crushing of chattel slavery. Sorry, that's just the real world. The crushing of chattel slavery was a more important advancement for our freedom than the Civil Rights Movement. As important as the Civil Rights Movement was, without the chains being,
right,
our existence was in peril in this type of slaveocracy system and stuff. And it didn't have to work out the way it did. There were people who played a role, a conscious role, in how that played out and when and how to seize the time. That's the real world. So all of this other type of stuff about electoral, even the Civil Rights Movement was not predicated on any electoral system. It was predicated on our social organizing, our grassroots and class conscious organizing. But this is just the degenerization and stuff. Now, when Hilliard talks about Huey talking about black capitalism, you know, reanalyzed, that Huey did. Now, it's true that Huey came out with a piece later on, Black Capitalism Reanalyzed, number one. This was June 5th, 1971. And that was during a period of the decline. But even with that, here's Huey's own words on some of this aspect. Point three of the original 10-point program of the Black Panther Party is, quote, "We want an end to the robbery by the capitalists of our black community," unquote. That was our position in October 1966, and it is still our position. We recognize that capitalism is no solution to the problems we face in our communities. Capitalist exploitation is one of the basic causes of our problem. It is the goal of the Black Panther Party to negate capitalism. However, many people have offered the community black capitalism as a solution to our problems. We recognize that people in the black community have no general dislike for the concept of black capitalism, but this is not because they are in love with capitalism. Not at all. The idea of black capitalism has come to mean to many people control of another one of the institutions in the community. We see within these characteristics the seeds of the negation of black capitalism and all capitalism in general. What we must do then is increase the positive qualities until they dominate the negative and therefore transform the situation. Now, even though, you know, I don't agree with some of his transforming of the situation and he's kind of, you know, so on and so forth, still, in 1971, he ain't saying capitalism is the way to go and all of that type of stuff and, you know, gets black businesses and so on and so forth. This is Huey's own writing in the Black Capitalism Reanalyzed in 1971, June 5th. And this is not even in his hardest phase concerning capitalism specifically. Once again, if you're going to mention these things, mention, you know, quote some of this stuff out. Be real about it. Don't just kind of, because it even hurts the legacy of what Huey stood for.
That's right. You know what? Mr. Hilliard is banking on something. He's banking on people like us, you and I, not existing. I'm talking about Tracy and Gerald. He's banking that no one will examine the record, that no one is familiar with the stuff. By the way, that's taken from To Die for the People. This book is very accessible, brothers and sisters. Check it yourself. Be familiar with your own history. And the Panthers is a part of our history.
Now next, let's go back to Jackson. Amy asked Jackson the events surrounding Martin King's assassination. Let's see what Jackson has to say and how this plays into this whole scenario. Check.
Your thoughts back at the Lorraine Motel. You ran to Dr. Martin Luther King just after he was assassinated.
Such a damn trauma. I mean, there had been a lot of tension because the demonstrations that focused on support the workers had been undercut by saboteurs. The media played on Dr. King could no longer control the people. The fact is, there were saboteurs to disrupt the march. But then our own organization, we found a very key person who was on the government payroll. So infiltration within, saboteurs from out, and the press attacks. He was being jammed at every level. But through all of that, by pulling together, we just had our collective strength, shared pain, and kept on fighting back. He spent much of that, the day, on April 3rd, he said to me, "I want you to go and speak for him tonight. I don't feel that well at the Mason Temple Church." I couldn't think of a line, literally. I mean, just like running on empty. And so I go up Dr. Abernathy that goes with me. So we went together, Ralph and I. We got to the church. It was raining very hard that night, and there was a tin-top roof on the church. And we got to the side. People saw us. They began to scream. So Ralph said, "They're not screaming. They think Martin is behind us. We should call him." So we went around to the front of the church, the pay telephone. We called. Got Bernard Lee on the phone, and "Dr. King, you must come. You don't have to speak long, but just, well, your presence is a big deal." So he said, "Well, I'll come." And that's when he came, and in that setting gave a very formal address, the "I have been to the mountaintop." It came out of that context. So the next day, we spent much of the day in the room talking about going to Washington and the Pope's campaign and all that went with that. Around 6, we were on our way to Reverend Billy Kyle's home for dinner. And Ben Branch, who was there with me, had played for him at our breadbasket meeting in Chicago about a month before the song Precious Lord. He said, Ben, be sure to play my song with Precious Lord. Ben said, I will. And he said, Jesse, you coming across the courtyard. You don't have enough time. We're going to dinner. I said, Doc, a tie is not a prerequisite for eating. An appetite is. He said, you are crazy. And we laughed. And then he raised up. I said, Doc. He said, and I said, Doc. And he said, oh. And that's the last we heard. It was a, this ringing shot. It hit him in the neck and went down and apparently blew his heart out. He never knew he was hit. But I will never believe that James Earl Ray had the motive, the money, not the mobility to have done it by himself. Our government was very involved in setting the stage for, and I think the escape route, James Earl Ray. A very painful day.
All right, now, the reason why I played that is not because of the whole King assassination, but what he said in the end, basically. Here Jackson is saying that he feels that his government, this government, was involved in the assassination of King, who he loved so dearly, on that painful day, to quote his own words, that they provided this escape route. They basically set it up. This is what Jackson is saying. Yet he still supports this system.
Today.
That's a demoralized, defeated Negro. No, let's see it as it really is. Because, look, if a cop shoots your mother and you find out that it's set up within the institution of the police or because of the way the institution is set up and you still support that, you're not only a fool, but you're a traitor.
That's right. My goodness, that, well, contradiction is clear.
Now, let's go once again back to Davey D, who asked Hilliard what he thinks about what people should do to turn things around. We already heard from Jackson, so check it.
What do you think are some of the two or three practical steps people should be taking to maybe turn around this tide? We got Bush in the White House. We got a whole bunch of his cronies, you know, trying to run things. You got, in my opinion, a disengaged Democratic Party that has not figured out how to accurately and dance with younger people, so they're disenfranchised to the point that they will either not participate or, you know, go in a totally different direction. You know, a lot of people voted for Arnold. I don't like Gray Davis. I'm voting for Arnold. They're paying a price now, but, you know, that's the result of that. So what do you think people should be doing to maybe turn things around? Insurmountable odds. But
well,
you all faced them.
Certainly the exigency, the first order of the business is to make Bush a one-term president. Get rid of George Bush. We got to do that. And that's going to take a monumental effort to get rid of George Bush. And, of course, down the line, we got to begin to take over some of the local political positions, city council, school board seats. So this generation has to become more involved in local politics. But first order of business, we got to get rid of George Bush.
Get rid of George.
Yeah,
okay.
He's a danger to the entire world.
We don't align ourselves with a particular party. It's usually by candidate at this point, I would imagine.
Well, you know, if we could reform the Democratic Party and make it a party for the people, then that's our work. I mean, we live in America. We ain't gonna have, no revolution anytime soon where we're gonna overthrow the two-party system. So in order for people to vote, they got to vote Democratic because Bush is a Republican. So it's important that we play the hand that we got.
What about some of those conservative Democrats that are doing the wrong
thing? Well, we got to get rid of them, too. I mean, that's the whole work. The work is to clean house. Let's take back that Democratic Party and make it operable and functional for the people. That's okay. Our work.
So you don't think you don't see a third party really rising?
Well, I think that we need to talk about the possibility of having a progressive third party. But in the interim, let's work to try to deal with the Democratic Party as it is.
So it's not an either-or
thing? It's not either-or.
Okay.
Not.
Well, that's something to think about there.
Okay, that's enough of it. Take back the Democratic Party. Very interesting concept. Very novel, I guess. You got to be out of your damn mind. You got to run for school board the Democrats are already running the city. Jerry Brown just rejoined the Democratic Party. What is this man? There's not an ounce of logic to... all right. Look, let's just get with the real thing. Forget about what David said, and let's talk. What do we need? We need a program. See, when you're talking about supporting or not supporting a regime or a candidate, it should always be based on what are these people going to do for me? What is their program? Is there some convergence here where we agree on a number of issues so that I can benefit or people in my social class will benefit from this particular organization being in power? How many times, how many crime Bill Clintons do we have to go through before people start to understand that both parties, the twin parties of capital, the Republicrats, are qualitatively similar. On all major issues, they share core values. That's the problem. If one could really seriously argue that the Democrats were for universal health care, and if they win, we get universal health care, if they win, we get jobs, if they win, this is going to improve for the black community, housing, whatever, then I would have to concede, well, maybe I'm wrong, you know, maybe we should support. But everybody knows, and the masses, nobody is, that that's not the case. And you program see, first.
And you've seen a continuous decline of American working class wages take place for the last 25 years. Everyone talks about the real dollar wages decline. American working class people are working more hours, et cetera, et cetera. And that's not even getting into the overall deterioration of the world working class population and the attacks on the third world that have been taking place. And the fact that, look, let's take something like Iraq. The Democrats basically helped set up the platform for the Republicans to springboard off to in this last campaign of death. It was the Democrats who kept the sanctions going those 8 years. Million people died during that process. And during that process, the UN and everyone else had realized that not only had Saddam Hussein been neutralized thoroughly, but that he no longer had any form of weapons of mass destruction or a program. But the Democratic Party was also maintaining a regime change, so that when they handed off the baton to the Republicans, everything was set in place for the next stage of the war to take place. It was a continuation of a war that the Democratic Party was doing when it unleashed those vicious sanctions on the people, or it maintained those vicious sanctions on the people of Iraq, maintained a no-fly zone to the point where you had an illegal fly zone where it was not backed up by any resolutions, yet the U.S. was maintaining this artificial resoluted fly zone area. This is all an attack and a continuous war that allowed Boy George and them to spring into the next stage of it. So these two worked hand in hand, the Democrats and Republicans, for this next stage that we're into. So this whole aspect of getting rid of Boy George, when it was Clinton who handed the baton to Boy George and company for the next stage to begin, and at the end, what you end up seeing is that you've heard from Hilliard, who is supposed to be in the legacy of the Panthers, but those of us who live in West Oakland, I'm born there and all of that type of stuff, know that that's not what it's all about. This person has left that whole construct and ideology a long time ago. And then you see Jesse Jackson, who's leading you back into the campaign. And then here you have Colin Powell, who basically at the end of the day can fit within the spectrum of the argument of what they're raising, because all three end up saying the same thing, just Negroes and black skin.
That turns out to be the case, and it can be the case. Now, the reason we have such a large shoe presence right now is that there are remnants of the old regime who don't want to see that happen. We don't want to stay there and be seen as an occupation force. We went there to liberate the country, and as soon as they're able to stand on their own 2 feet, have their own government that they have decided upon, and they have selected, and they have their own security forces,
will be leaving.
Will it be a model? Is that what you're hoping for?
Well, why wouldn't I want it to be a model? I mean, it is...
Yes, I should say, do you expect that?
Sure, I would. Why? We should work toward that end. We believe that lots of things are changing in the Persian Gulf and Middle East region. Libya has decided to give up its weapons of mass destruction. You can see a large amount of churning taking place within Iran. Syria is measuring where it wants to be when this is all over. So there's a lot happening in that part of the world. And I think there's no reason that Iraq, with our assistance and assistance of the international community, especially the UN, could not turn out to be the kind of democracy we would be proud of having helped create and could serve as an example, not a model to be copied, but an example of what is possible.
The military victory in Iraq was decisive. The search for the weapons of mass destruction has not been, at least not till now. When you spoke to the Security Council 1 year ago, you told them that based on the evidence, not on conjecture, there is no doubt that Saddam Hussein has chemical weapon stocks and biological weapons capability to rapidly produce more. That's not an exact quote, by the way. What was wrong with the intelligence that you were given?
I don't know that there was anything wrong with the intelligence. We're still looking, we're still searching. The one thing that was absolutely clear is that he had the intention to have such weapons, and he had programs to develop such weapons. What we weren't sure about is how many such weapons he actually had, but we had every reason to believe that he had such weapons.
Now, my whole point in playing Colin Powell in the end is to show that he's in such contradiction, and as you've heard us do for the months, we've slashed and ridiculed and completely deconstructed the myth-making apparatus of Boy George and Colin Powell and these other thugs who have launched this imperial war. But within the context of what you heard Jesse Jackson say and what you heard Hilliard say, this more or less sounds like a reasonable debate, because they all use the art of doublespeak. They all use slights of and misdirections of history and stuff. They leave out large portions of the truth. And at the end of the day, they do that because they're leading you right back on the plantation and where you can debate within the confines of the Democrat and Republican Party, and i.e. the market system. But to go outside of that, you sound ridiculous. Where in reality, anyone who supports them in the real world is not only ridiculous, but putting their own future in jeopardy. And to show you right quick an example of how far things have deteriorated, we have a situation where there's like a quote-unquote liberal talk show. It's a KGO 810, and they have a host named Bernie Ward, who's kind of an outspoken liberal. And he's often lambasted Bush in his campaign of war against the Iraqi people and this and that, and pointed out many of the lies and stuff like that. But his callers, who believe in the Democratic Republican lexicon system, getting caught up in Democrats as a solution in the long run can deteriorate your own mind.
Yes.
Now here's a caller who actually does not like Bush, but just listen right quick to what has happened to this caller over being involved in this kind of process of thinking that you can vote your way to freedom within the spectrum of the Democrat and Republican Party. And you can see the links between him, Hilliard, Jackson, and Colin Powell. Check this out.
What's called in is overlooked, and they seem to have forgotten. But, I'm not on anybody's side. That's why I'm on the world side, the planet. When he burned those oil wells, if we didn't put those oil wells out right now, they'd still be burning. Our vegetation, 10 years of burning oil like that. I saw the IMAX film.
Excuse me, please.
And that was like a crime.
The Soviet Union. The Soviet Union did far more to the environment than Saddam Hussein will ever do.
But because we put the fires out, we don't know. We stopped them.
The Soviet Union did more environmental harm. China, by building a dam that they just finished.
Yeah.
Has done massive environmental harm.
And they're not good guys.
And the United States.
And they're communists too.
And the United States is the direct cause of most of the global warming in the world.
Right. We are a big energy consumer. Yes, we are. But
whatever you're talking about Saddam Hussein, let's just boil it down. Tell me what George Bush said was the reason why we should go to war with Iraq.
Oh, I know George Bush. He misled the people to get the way, whatever way he could to get
right.
it.
So if you mislead, your family's all Marines.
If
you take Americans that are willing to fight for their country, and you're the commander-in-chief, and you throw their lives away on a war that you didn't have to fight, a war that that the guys in your administration have been trying to get for 10 years, a war in which you're already dividing up the oil fields as to who's going to get the contracts, and you ask Marines to go over there, among others, and to die, and it turns out they're dying for nothing.
Okay, well,
could you be reelected as president?
Well, I have. You know what's funny is I have a customer who has the exact name as somebody on one of your guys. I don't want to tell his name, but one of your hosts. He happens to have the same name. His son just came back from Tikrit last week, and I got there. I talked to him for about an hour and a half, and he was telling me that in that town of Tikrit, that the people, 95% of the people, are just so thankful that we have done this. The people that are
Please don't go there.
People that are shooting are the business.
Excuse me. We have in our coalition fighting with us on our side.
Mm-hmm.
The nation of Uzbekistan.
Mm-hmm.
In that nation, the leader boils his enemies.
Okay.
He has 10,000 political prisoners in jail.
Okay.
He makes Saddam Hussein look like a choir boy.
And we'll get to him next.
We're going to get him next. We just sent him $500 million. We just stationed troops in his country, which, by the way, will keep him in power.
Well, we probably used him.
So please don't tell me that the reason that people died over there was to liberate the people of Iraq.
Well, that's not the only reason.
It wasn't any other reason. You can't even find President Bush saying that anywhere.
No, well, you know, you got his sons. You got Saddam Hussein's sons. And
yeah.
Well,
I'll tell you what. If you had lost somebody over in Iraq and found out that we didn't have to fight it, found out that we were lied to, and the only thing they could tell you now was, well, at least Saddam Hussein is gone. I don't think
I rely on the Bush administration to make up my mind. I talk to people who've lived there.
To make up your mind for what? If you're going to go after it, tell me why you're going to go after him instead of all the other dictators in the world.
When Saddam Hussein was in power, some people were doing good. Some people were happy with him. Some people liked him. They weren't all didn't like him. Those are the people that are upset right now because they don't have their money coming.
Why are we there at all?
Why are we there at all?
If it's to liberate those people, why those people when there's so many other countries that are enslaved? Why the Iraqis?
All of them at once.
Well, then tell me why this one.
This is the next one on the list.
On what list? For what reason?
Well, when he invaded Kuwait.
That's right. And that was over with. He was contained.
I know we put him in power.
He was contained.
A lot of people changed.
He was contained. He represented no threat to anybody. Why this one?
Oh, well, when he obtained the money, Kuwaitis, they spread the money around.
He was contained. He represented no threat to anyone.
Uh-huh.
So why now?
People that were in the mass graves.
Well, so there are a lot of people in mass graves all over. Why this country?
You know what he did with little girls?
There are plenty of people in mass graves. Why this country?
Now listen to me.
There are plenty of people in mass graves in countries all over the world. Why this country?
Really? There is? What other countries has mass graves?
You want to go to Rwanda? You want to go to Angola? Do you want to go all over the African continent? Do you want to go to China? Do you want to go to the Soviet Union? Do you want to go to Georgia? Would you like to go to North Korea? How many more countries would you like? Tell me why this country.
They're not killing innocent people.
They're killing innocent people. They're killing innocent people constantly. Jonas Savimbi. Jonas Savimbi has killed tens of thousands of innocent people.
Have they been doing that since the beginning of time?
They've been doing that for the last 20 years.
They've been doing that for thousands of years.
No, 20 years. This government, Savimbi, backed by us. Tell me why the people of Iraq needed to be liberated over everybody else.
Why did the Crusaders...
Why did the people of Iraq need to be liberated over everybody else?
Because they could be involved in the world of trade. They can be involved now. They can be in free trade. They can start to change...
Any one of those countries... Why was Iraq picked instead of all the other countries that could have been picked?
They're centrally located.
For what?
To a lot of religions.
Oh, my God.
There's a lot of... You got Islam...
I do hope you've retired. Are you retired?
No, I'm not.
Oh, God, you can't be making a living. Because if that's the kind of reasoning that you use for your job, I am absolutely and utterly blown away. You really should have gone to bed.
No,
because if Americans are dying so that the Iraqis can go back to business.
No,
if Americans are dying because Iraq is central.
It's just that, it's that basic.
Americans are dying because of what?
It's a combination of things.
What's the other combination?
You want to make it one thing. You
What's
make
the combination? The Iraqi people can be business people.
I don't like Bush. I don't.
I don't care what you like. You've got the intellectual prowess of a flea.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay.
My God.
Yeah, well.
So Americans had to die so the Iraqis can open up businesses?
No, that's not the only...
Americans had to die because the Iraqis are central to something? What are they central to?
They're in the middle of the Arab community. We showed them...
Everyone is. Every nation in the Middle East is in the middle of the Arab community.
Why don't we know?
In Saudi Arabia, they're beheading people. They're burying people. They're killing people. They burned a school down with women in it because they didn't wear the right dress. How come we haven't liberated them?
And you think it's going to lead to more terrorism, other countries knowing that we're not...
I don't think so. The Army War College says it will.
Countries have space shuttles.
Do you ever listen to the Army War College?
How many other countries have space shuttles?
How many other countries have terrorists? How many other countries now have a reason to attack us?
Listen, can I tell you one thing?
No, we're done. Thank you very much. Go to bed. Please go to bed. I mean, that's the worst. That shows, it really does show, that whatever the ability to think is in this country, it has really gone down the drain.
Now, as we go into the next phase in our lives, and when you start raising your kids, don't just tell your kids how their minds will be destroyed on drugs, but tell them that this will be your mind on Democratic Party. If you believe in the Democratic Party and vote for the Democratic Party and rationalize your energy and intellectual thought into justifying the Democratic Party, that too will be you in the years to come. I mean, so look, this is the people, this is a creation of Jesse Jackson and Hilliard and Colin Powell. They've got these knuckleheads in America trapped in this little Democratic Party versus Republican Party thing, thinking that and pretending like there's some kind of solution and that there's some real intellectual stimulation that you can get out of that when it, at the end of the day, you just heard the end result of what happens to someone who tries to rationalize their way through an irrational, and inhumane system. Now, while the liberal, Bernie Ward, had to deal with demoralized, buffoonish Democratic callers like that, I flipped over to see and hear what was the pressing topic that Bill O'Reilly was talking about, considering the fact that O'Neill, you know, the guy who was in the cabinet with Bush, came out with a book about, you know, how the war planners in Bush administration had planned to attack Iraq right from day one. Well, here's what O'Reilly was talking about on his show.
We disagree with Zakat, one of the city council people who voted against the Boy Scouts. We admired his courage to come on a factor and debate it with us. Now, just some background in case you didn't catch the piece or the radio discussion last week. Boy Scouts of America use Balboa Park in San Diego for some of their activities. It's a city-owned park. ACLU sued because they don't like the Boy Scouts because the Boy Scouts won't admit homosexuals and atheists, all right? Because the Boy Scout O says, to do my duty to God and my country and obey the Scout law, to keep myself physically strong, mentally awake, and morally straight, okay? So, the Boy Scouts told us they define God as nature. It could be anything from nature. There isn't a specific God. It's not like the Boy Scouts said you have to believe in Jesus or Buddha or Allah or you or Moses. No. It's just basically they want you to take a theistic approach that there is a higher power. And so anyway, you'll remember that this pinhead, incredible pinhead federal judge out there ruled that the Boy Scouts were a religious organization, had no right to have any kind of sweetheart deal with the city of San Diego. Napoleon Jones is the guy's name. Now, we, from the very beginning, have defended the Boy Scouts by saying it isn't a religious organization, because it isn't. It isn't, all right? It doesn't take a point of view on what kind of...
That's enough. My whole point in playing this is that, you know, what O'Reilly's doing is pressing silly emotional buttons for demoralized people who have... who aren't really fighting for a clean cup of water, but want to get all up in bothered about some Boy Scout issue when the real issues are going on in the world. The wars, the global warming, holes in the ozone, depletion of the ocean, all of this type of madness going on, and O'Reilly knows just what to do to keep you stupefied. So you've seen what he does on his show. You see Bernie Ward and some of his listener who's just so out to lunch and demoralized and buffoonized that it's pathetic. And then you see how they get there by believing that there is a solution between a Colin Powell and a difference between a Colin Powell, a Hilliard, and a Jackson. That's where you'll end up if you go in that claptrap of deceit in the end of the day. Hold on a sec.
Brothers and sisters and friends, and I see some enemies. In fact, I think we'd be fooling ourselves if we had an audience this large and didn't realize that there were some enemies present.
All right, good evening, brothers and sisters. I just got two quick items for you because I know our program is about to end here. I want the trade union supporters out there and those who support the rights of labor to understand that the strike and lockout of 70,000 United Food and commercial workers, brothers and sisters, in Southern California, this is at a turning point right now. These workers have been on strike or locked out of Safeway, Albertsons, and Ralph's stores in L.A., in that area, since October 11th. The grocery chains want to slash health care coverage for current workers and basically eliminate it for new workers. The strike is really important because if Safeway succeeds, it will send a signal to employers in Northern California and throughout the state to slash health care coverage. Every one of us could be next. Any one of us could be next. These grocery workers are not striking over $5 to $15 a week in health care insurance premiums like the supermarkets claim. Current employees would have to pay $95 a week out of a 12-hour salary. $12 an hour salary for health care by the third year of the contract. You see, it goes up progressively. Safeway is trying to basically eliminate health care for all new hires, going back on its commitment to provide good union jobs in our communities, even though it continues to make huge profits. If the grocery workers are to win this fight, they need the help of every union member and every supporter of labor rights from north to south in escalating the fight for health care. The San Francisco Labor Council is calling on all union members and supporters of labor rights in San Francisco and across the Bay Area to step up their support of these embattled workers. This is what the Labor Council is asking working people to do to support the strike. Number one, don't shop at Safeway. Actually, I would add Albertsons. The San Francisco labor movement has targeted Safeway for a boycott campaign. We need to do this. The company, the only place hit it and the only place it understands, and that is its wallet. The Labor Council is recommending the targeted times of 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. on weekdays and 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. on weekends. But any time you can help is greatly needed. There are UFCW workers from Southern California on picket lines during working hours every day of the week. Look, contact the Labor Council. Get over there and help out. Contribute to the strike fund if you can. Checks should be sent to the United Food and Commercial Workers State Council Strike Fund. You have to contact Walter Johnson at the San Francisco Labor Council. Come on, let's make this happen. Our brothers and sisters need our help. Also, on the question of stopping the execution of Kevin Cooper, I'll give a better update next week in the fight to free this innocent man on death row. That's going to be all for the Make It Plain News Service. Check y'all later.
just going to about wrap it up with Slade tonight. As it's clear that from Hilliard to Jackson to Colin Powell, no matter what kind of label they have on themselves or those in the outside have labeled them as, they basically are Negroes in black skin who want us back on or want to maintain us on the plantation. And for the black men of the world, the black women of the world, to all people of the world, we can't handle that no longer. So sisters and brothers, it's time to stand up. At least for the real black women, black men, and people on this earth. Until the next time, slave revolt. Out.